Leonard Charles has been in broadcast engineering for over 40 years and currently holds the position of Director of Engineering for Morgan Murphy Media's Midwest Division. He has served on numerous national broadcast engineering committees with the FCC, MSTV, and NAB. Leonard currently serves on the NAB TV Technology Committee and its Next Generation Broadcast Platform Committee, and on the Wisconsin EAS and Amber Alert Committees. He was awarded in 2013 NAB Engineering Achievement Award for Service to Broadcast Engineering. He is a former SBE director, a current SBE NS trustee, and is an SBE fellow. And Leonard is also the chair of the Broadcast Clinic Committee, and believe it or not, he has been with the committee for over 20 years. Everybody, Leonard Charles.
All right, let's. This next session isn't going to tax your brain or anything. We got a lot of pictures, some movies. Before I get started, she did mention that I'm one of the SBE Ennis trustees. There's only three of us in the country, and there are two of them in this room. Fred Baumgartner is the other one. Thanks, you, Fred. So if you want to donate money to the SBE Ennis Trust, either one of us will take it. All right, we didn't plan this, but I see I have the same background and font as Jeremy did on his presentation. Great minds think alike. Is that how that goes? Now, I'm sure a lot of you people in this room kind of know what I'm going to talk about today. There'll be a little bit that you maybe don't know as clearly with the Method of Moments, but the Method of Moments is a pretty small part of this presentation. I know we all know the theory of how AM radio works and how it's built and the ground system and the isocouplers and the da-da-da-da-da. But I didn't know that maybe everybody in this room has ever experienced the actual building of one of them from scratch to see exactly what goes into one. So I thought it'd be fun to take a look at that because I've had the opportunity to knock that off my bucket list when I built one last year. So we took a lot of pictures, and I think you'll enjoy this. So we're going to cover today the building of the AM directional array with the Method of Moments design that went into it. We'll cover near the end the ongoing certification of the and operation of the Method of Moments and what it takes to keep yourself operating into the future as far as the FCC is concerned. And then we'll take a few moments at the end to show you how we knocked the old towers down after we were done building the new part. That was the fun part. This is the old site. This is in Platteville, Wisconsin. The station is WPVL. It's a 1 kilowatt day non-directional and 500 watts night directional. And the site, the first tower, the closest one, the reference tower was built in the 1950s. And in the early 60s, the second tower was added and the station went directional. The original transmission lines and sample lines were all buried, and they started causing us a lot of headaches, trying to keep the thing stable. And almost 4 years ago, we had to apply to the FCC for an STA to continue operation. It was that unstable. And the only requirement that we had to, of course, was to keep the monitor points legal. The rest of the parameters, the phase and the ratio and that, they didn't care anymore. Just keep your monitor points legal, and then the STA was granted. The STAs go for 6 months each. I was hoping that we'd only need one or two and we'd be moved to a new site. 3 years later, we're still applying for STA extensions and getting them. In the meantime, in order to keep it running in any fashion, we had to string some transmission line and some sample lines above ground and replace some of the stuff below ground. The original array was, one of the towers was 50 ohms and the other tower was 70 ohms. So it was an interesting combination of to make an array. This worked pretty well. We had to put the flags out because through the wintertime, there's a lot of snowmobiling and ATVing going on in this lot. It's in the middle of the city now. And we didn't have too much trouble, except one day we got knocked off the air. And when we went out there, we discovered that the transmission line, the one to the left, I have the laser. Can you give that, Kevin? Transmission line to the north tower, that guy, was laying on the ground and was actually physically pulled out of the building and out of the phaser. And next to it was the back bumper of a car. No car, just the back bumper. We never figured out who did it, but somebody was joyriding through our lot and hooked our lines and pulled them apart. So we had to put her together again and add some more extensions to the line. This was the original building of the station, located on 4th Street in Platteville. It was an old house to begin with, converted to a radio station. And near the end, this station held all of the administrative, all of the sales, and three of the studios for our five station cluster down there. They were all crammed into this old house. And yes, it was in really, really bad shape. The mice loved it, and the bees. There's an STL tower next to it that we put up in modern day times. It got even worse when the tree was blown over during a lightning storm, and then the roof started leaking, and we had minor floods inside the building. So I think maybe it was this picture that finally convinced our upper management that it's time to leave. So we went out searching. We identified four plots throughout the area. We actually got FAA approval on three of them. We ran into some land negotiation problems with one of them. And so I don't remember what happened to the other one, but we went out looking again and we found this one. This is the site is actually right up here. We leased 5 acres of a hayfield. The problem with that site is it's landlocked. It does not have access to the road where I'm standing taking this picture. So we had to negotiate a lease for not only the hayfield, we also had to negotiate a lease for the driveway to get to the hayfield. So we have two landowners involved, two leases that we pay annually on. We really wanted this site badly, as you can tell. This is the no hazard determination from the FAA for this site. You can see down at the bottom, they're not tall, they're 193 feet. We're far enough away from the Platteville Municipal Airport that we were not required to paint them red and white, and we did not have to light them. So the towers are just going to be galvanized steel. And for those of you keeping score, this is a 1590 kilohertz station, so 193 feet is actually more than a quarter wave. It turns out to be about 114 degrees electrical to the system. So that had to be factored into the design. So the first thing you do once you get FAA approval is then you plot out a site map. By the way, I hired Rich Wood, Resident Results, to be my general on this project. So Rich provided most of what you're going to see here. Rich, thank you. And at the end, if there's any tough questions, Rich will answer them. So Rich did up the site plot. You can see they're on 350 degrees true. The two towers, we have a double ground field. We'll have the 150-foot ground field, and then closer in, we have a 50-foot second ground field. I should mention at this point, back in the old days, what you would do is you'd send a crew in there, and you'd take some really long core samples of your dirt, and you get that send-off for analysis, and you get the soil content. And we don't have to do that anymore. Now you contract. Anybody remember Dave Davies? He used to speak here quite a bit. He has a company now that we contracted, and they query a geological database. I think it's a government database. And they get the information back on the piece of ground that you're looking at, and you get a printout that tells you what the soil content is. So you save all this mud and dust and lab fees to do it that way. And it was pretty reasonable. You can see the building was placed so that the transmission lines would be equal length, so we didn't have to play the game of burying excess transmission line under the ground like you sometimes have to do with existing arrays. And so that was that's the layout. This is the crew. You see Rich on the tailgate. This is the electrician. That's the electrical company. You want to get them involved early, by the way, because it takes them a long time to come to speed of your project. And this is Chris Krieger. His company, RF Specialties, out of Missouri, was the winning bidder for all the equipment that went into this project. And Chris is a get-involved type of guy, so he drove up from Missouri the day I told him we were going to plot the land, and there he is in his jeans helping us. He really likes this stuff. Okay, so the first thing we did was locate the base tower over here, and right now that's Rich and Chris finding the location for the second tower. the old-fashioned way. And then you bring in a surveyor, and he takes his GPS gizmo out, and he plots the site using the GPS coordinates, which are, no offense, Rich, but they're a little more accurate than the old-fashioned way. And then he tells you how far off you were with your second tower placement. And as you can see, that distance there, that's about an 8-foot distance. So we didn't miss it by much, but we missed it by a little bit. And knowing all this stuff and having it that accurate really saves some headaches toward the end of the project when you have to make the thing play the way it's supposed to play. You want to make sure that you get one of these. It's very popular on a site when you're doing this kind of a build. And the site is actually on the other side of this fence line, and this side was a cow pasture, and we were visited frequently by the ladies. For some reason, they really thought the station pickup truck tasted good. And they would come out and they would lick it all over. As a matter of fact, it's a kind of a joke between Kevin and I. When I go down now to take a sample reading or check the array out, and then I come back, Kevin comes to me and says, "You were in Grant County, weren't you?" He could tell by all the cow licks all over the windshield and mirrors and door handles if I don't get the thing washed on the way back. We were very fortunate because up the road, this way, the farmer had a barn that was, it was not an agricultural barn anymore, it was a cattle barn, but he had an electric pump. So to water his cattle, he had to maintain power up there. So power lines passed right by the site. That was very, very fortunate. We're putting up the temporary power here. The power pole that used to be here was the 1930s vintage, and it was no longer strong enough to support that transformer. So the power company did have to swap out the power pole. This is the slab for the building. We had a stick-built building, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But what I want you to notice here is the two conduits. There were only a couple of things I insisted on in this build. And one of them was I wanted the cables in conduits, underground, and as strong a conduit as we could buy. And so there's two conduits there, one that will be headed for each tower. Right now, they're just stubbed out into the ground and waiting for the trenches to go out to the tower. But that's where that is. Now, a single ground point, we hear that time and time again in every session that we touch on with grounding, especially with Jeff from Nautel. You want to have a single ground point in your array, in your complex. So we chose this corner of the building, and that location is going to be where all the utilities will come in, all the utilities will ground there. All of the ground system in the tower will home run and ground there. And all the equipment inside the building will all get ground strapped and grounded to this single point. So we have a single point of ground in this installation. That's the stick building I was talking to you about. It was we contracted a local building company and told them what we wanted. Rich did all the negotiating and the design, and this is the start of the building. Now you'll notice, one of the other things I insisted on is absolutely, positively, no rodents. I do not want rodents in this building. And so Rich contracted to sheathe the inside with steel. So these are just under 1/8-inch thick steel plates that the construction crew was not fond of putting in. But they did, and when they were done, the entire wall, all the walls, all the way around, there will be no rodents in here because it's tight to the concrete slab. They can't get under it. The only way they could possibly get in it if they somehow found their way into the attic and then chewed through the ceiling plywood. But so far, no problems there, not even scratching. Let's see, I think that's all I want to say about that. So here's the finished building. It's only a 1,000 watt. Actually, we're licensed for 970 watts. We had a little close quarter a situation where we had to go down to 970 watts. And so a simple window air conditioning unit is all we need to keep the thing cool in the wintertime. We have a solid state transmitter in there. We put in a Nautel, I think it's a J1000. There's Chris. Hi, Chris. You want one of these on your site. Now, I'm not saying that Platteville, Wisconsin has a big scare for copper thievery, but you never want to take a chance. So this is a cargo trailer that was dropped on the site with a good locking system. So everything that is copper and beyond went inside and was locked up every night. And we didn't have a problem with any theft through the whole project. Yeah, they really are. So is the porta potty, by the way. The first thing you want to build, I want you to note that over the steel sheathing, we did plywood the walls inside to make it easier to mount things to it. So we didn't have to be drilling through steel all the time. So you'll see that there is plywood and painted white inside. But the first thing you need to do is build your workbench, and as soon as you leave, it gets stacked up to the ceiling with boxes. A couple of racks we salvaged from the TV station here in Madison and took down there that would be more than enough room for the equipment we needed for the project. Then the towers arrived. The towers were purchased through Chris, and they're Saber towers. And as we showed you earlier, they were 193 feet tall with the lightning protection on the top. We'll get to that in a little bit. They are 2-foot face triangular, and they're a little bit bigger than what was probably necessary, but we did that to cut down on the number of guy wires that we would need. So each tower has only 3 levels of guy wires. And they're made to the specification of ANSI 222G for 90 miles per hour with no ice, and 40 miles per hour with 3/4-inch ice. So there they are arriving on the truck. There we are unloading them. The people who built the building lent us their lull so we could unload them and set them in the ground. There you have 2 towers. The things in the front are the guy anchors. They're about, I think, 12 feet long, something like that. And it's pretty easy to put them together because it's like Tinker Toys. You can see a little identification code at the bottom plate of each section. And that tells the tower crew how to put them together, because they were put together at the factory and then they were taken apart for shipping, and the factory wants you to put them together the same way for strength, obviously, because there was one tower where we're putting the STL antenna at the top, so it was built accordingly to take that load. There's the guy wires. These are, they used to call these Philly strand. I don't know what they call them now, but they're fiberglass sections that go at the top of each guy wire run for insulating. And the base insulators and miscellaneous other stuff are located in those barrels. Now, the phaser was purchased from Phase Tech, and they ran into a little scheduling issue where they were not meeting our timeline. And it's nothing against them. They're great people and they build great stuff. They just got a little behind. And so when they did finally get it built, they actually rented a truck and drove it from Pennsylvania to our front door. There was no shipper involved. They just took it right straight to us. And that was a rainy day. I think it was a Tuesday. So here we are unloading the phaser. You can see it inside the building there. And this is what it looked like after it's been placed, and the 2 equipment racks, one on either side. And again, here's our grounding point. I think I got this slide a little too early, but you can see the utilities are now in. Although the power was running right past the property, the phone line wasn't, and we needed a phone line for remote control, so we had to bury that in from the main road, along the path we had to purchase the easement to, and that was about maybe a third to a half of a mile that the phone company had to get the lines in. You see these couple of copper bears here. Those are actually static drain wires that ran on the outside of the conduits buried along with them out to the towers for an additional path for the lightning to take should we get a hit. A little of a precaution. This is Rich doing up our ground system on the inside of the building. Then the tower crew arrived, and the first thing they did was start putting together the re-rod cages for the base of the towers. That's what they're doing there. And this is a re-rod cage for the guy anchor. So once they were done with that, the tower crew we used was, I got it written down here. I know his name is Bill Johnson. What was the name of his company, Rich? Pardon me? Rocky Mountain Tower, Rocky Mountain Erection, actually. And so they came with their own backhoe, they came with their own, the only thing they didn't have was the machine to bury the ground system, and it took them a while to find one, but they found one. They're very particular at how they want to do things, and that's not a bad thing. Bill is a little bit of a perfectionist, but boy, does he do a good job, and he watches over everything really, really closely, so nothing slips by him. I mean, when we were hoisting one of the towers, we did it by crane, you'll see, and the crane got kind of caught in one of the guy anchors, and a little chip fell off a guy, Johnny Ball, that was destined for the top of the towers. And one of his crew told him about it, and he ordered some new ones, and he made sure he went up there, and they replaced it before they left the site. So he's very conscientious, a very good person. He's a little crazy, but tell me any tower person that is not. This is the hole. It's about 6 to 7 feet deep for the tower base, and there's the re-rod cage in the bottom. Then the Jeffries tube goes over the top of the cage, and we're ready for the concrete truck. This is the hole for the guy anchors, and you can see that's about a 5 foot deep hole with a cage in the bottom, and then the concrete being poured over the guy anchor itself. This is what it looks like after the concrete is poured and it's curing. And then the truck moved on to the towers. This was all poured in the same day, I think, or within a day or two anyway. This is what the tower pad looks like. Those three bolts are about 2 feet long, and there will be a plate mounted to them, and that will be where the base insulator balances on when we hoist the towers up. This guy's job was to get a couple of core samples in those yellow tubes, because they will not stack steel until a lab tells them that the concrete is strong enough for it. It takes about 7 days for the concrete to cure enough for a lab to give it a stress test, and I think we tested out at about 2,500 pounds per square inch, if I recall. I think that was it. And then we could start stacking the steel. While we were waiting for those tests to happen, we took off and started digging the trenches. This is the trench for one of the, this is to the North Tower. And there we go. For one of the trenches, they decided they were going to take the 10-foot sections of conduit, run them over the transmission and control lines, and then glue them in the bottom of the trench. By the second trench, they got a little wiser, and they decided to run the transmission lines and glue it all together up top, and then get enough people down in the trench to slowly lower it into the bottom of the trench. And that proved out to be faster and a lot easier than somebody trying to crawl around in a little narrow trench gluing. This is what it looks like when it's all done. I'm hopeful and confident that it'll last. I mean, what I fear most is a rock being heaved around in the weather and then eventually cracking the conduit. But I have to tell you, the whole time we put the ground system in, and the part when I was there when they were digging, I wasn't there for all of it, but I never saw them hit a rock. Did you, Rich? It was amazing how rock-free this parcel of land was, so we hit it pretty lucky there. Bill did. Bill had his own trencher. He brought it with him.
Did Bill drive the trencher?
Yep.
That's a nice, straight trencher.
Yeah. He's very good. I'm not going to make any commercials out of it, but I'd hire him again if I had a project like this. This is the start of the grounding system. That plate is what will support the insulator, and then the grounding goes down straps, and this is the framework that will act as an attachment point for the actual ground radials when we get to putting them in. The ATUs, one for each tower, we decided to mount them on treated lumber. Those are 6x6 and by about 10 feet tall. They're in the ground almost 4 feet. And each ATU is mounted. You can see the tower pad is there. And then this is the conduit from the building with the wires waiting to be attached to that. The towers were going to be hoisted with a crane. They're only 193 feet, so I think we got the crane from Dubuque, wasn't it? And they had a crane big enough to go ahead and hoist that kind of height. So rather than try to do it with a gin pole and all that, we just got the crane. Three sections, roughly about 160 feet each. The top section of each, since we didn't have to have lighting, these are static dissipators. I think we bought those from ERI, correct? Yeah. To help dissipate the lightning a little bit. I don't know. Oh, yeah. That's right. The towers themselves were not 193 feet, but those static added the length that we needed for the tower. So they were factored into the tower design. When the tower was put together, we bead welded every junction, all three at each level, for electrical continuity. They pre-made the guy cables with the Johnny balls, And then there's the crane hoisting up the first section of the first tower. There's the insulator. The whole tower rests on that guy at the bottom of the tower. So they're lining it up as the crane gently drops it down. Yeah. Each section was 60 feet. Is that the question? Or yeah. Mm-hmm. The guy wires went in one section at a time, and they did some. This is the first time I ever saw this, but I don't know if these guys ever used whatever you call the meter is to measure guy tension. They just kind of they looked at the droop of the cable, and they tensioned the tower that way, and it came out straight. So this wasn't his first rodeo. He'd been doing a lot of these. There's the mounting of the second section of that tower. And this is the third section going up. This is taken from the top of the second section. Now, I think I have, here we go. We'll see it go up in record time. It's kind of like the Keystone Cops of putting towers together. Yeah. This is where they had a little trouble with those lightning things getting caught in the crane, so they had to figure that out. Afterwards, they had to go up on top and straighten the lightning arresters out. And so there you go. One tower's up. How long did that take? Not too long. This is the tower crew, and I had to throw this slide in there. Bill Johnson, he's the guy who owns the company and takes it personal. He goes on the road with I don't know, most or all of his jobs. And he wanted you to know that he's a Denver Broncos fan. Because while we were building this array, we started in October of 20... Well, we started the actual build. It started out much earlier than that. But the actual build started in October 1 year ago, 2013, and ran through, I think we got licensed at the end of January 2014. And so that was during the Denver Broncos Super Bowl run. And you'd want to avoid being around the site on Monday mornings because you'd have to listen to Denver Broncos stories for most of that morning. But that's Bill, and Clayton is next to him. Tyrone is the next one, and John is the furthest on the right. I really didn't actually know Clayton's name until I was putting this together, and I had to contact Bill and ask him who the guy's name was, because he was called a whole bunch of different names, some of them very colorful. So he also was, he left or got kicked out of his original hotel room and had to go find another one. You know, typical Tower Crew stuff. Yeah, there were some fascinating stories. Okay, here they are putting the bracket together to mount the STL antenna, which will go on the north tower. And then their further prep, setting the lightning gap, I think, is what he's doing here. See this can of spray paint? The first thing they did when they got this all finished was they spray painted the copper gray so it looked like concrete. So it wasn't attractive from the road. You know, if the sun hits it at the right angle when you're driving a third of a mile away, it can get pretty attractive to some people who are looking for that. So they did paint every bit of exposed copper gray, like concrete. This is a transverse strap between the towers. This one's buried about 3 feet deep, and it's to bond the two towers together. At the halfway point, because Rich designed this very symmetrical, there'll be a pig tie strap that'll be jutting out of the soil after it's buried, and that will attach to the center strap that goes between the towers and back to the building. I think I have a picture of it. Well, they did put ground rods in at each tower base as well to further bond the grounding system. This is that strap that I was telling you about, and that orange-pink line is after the grounding system is in, there'll be a short trench dug there and a strap laid in there to attach the intersecting grounding radials to. Because when you have two towers this close together, what were they, about 156 feet apart, I think? When you have them that close together and you've got 150 feet of guy wires, well, a lot of them will intersect in the middle. So you cut them off where they intersect, and then you lay a solder strap and bond them to the solder strap. That's how you make a ground system.
That also makes for a very, very electrically stable ground system.
Yes. You should use the mic, Chris. People will find that interesting. Cliff?
It's on already. Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, having the ground radials going out toward both of the towers bond to a strap in the middle just contributes toward having a electrically rock stable ground system through all kinds of weather conditions.
And I have to comment on that. Now that we it's not quite been licensed for a year, but we have gone through the seasons, winter to summer. Now we're in fall, and we're going to go back into winter. And it's been rock solid so far. The phase has not drifted more than 0.2 of a degree. It's been amazing. And I've worked in a lot of AM directional systems, and I've never been able to say that about any of them. So it helps. The guy that we lease the farmland from, he has a side business. He has a tire shop. So when your backhoe blows a tire, you just call Dewey up, and he runs out there with his truck and replaces the tire. The grounding system now is every 3 degrees. It's a number 10 bare copper wire. These flags that you see on this picture are where the end of each 150-foot radio will be in a circle around each tower. This is the apparatus that it took them forever to find, and I think they ended up going to Nebraska to have it trucked in because they couldn't find one locally. No? Is that right? Yeah. It took that long for them to... He insisted on having this machine, and you'll see why later. I've seen this done in the 80s when Fred and I did a rebuild of the IBA one here in town, and they used a little Ford tractor with a ditch witch on the back to put in the new ground system in that one. But Bill insisted it had to be a Caterpillar, and it had to be this particular model of Caterpillar, and he couldn't find one anywhere until he got to Nebraska, and then he had it trucked in. Now, the ground radials are these number 10, and they attach to the middle tine here, and then that goes into the ground, and they pull, and I think we have there's one being started. I think we have a video here of how it goes. Here we go. Another fast-moving caterpillar. But you can see that he did the short one, then he backed up, hooked up, rehooked, and then did the long one and did that again. So it was short, long, all the way around each tower. Short ones, again, were 50 feet. That's depicted by that trench right there. And then the long ones are the end flags. Now, this is going to be in real time, so we get to see how this machine works. He's doing one of the 50-footers now. And again, remarkable, he never hit a rock doing this. That's just unbelievable to me. The farmer wasn't too thrilled in how we were chewing up his field. I tried to prepare him for that, but I don't think I prepared him enough. So now they'll come up. You can see he cut the cable off, and now he's mending it to that framework at the bottom of the tower while the cat's getting ready to take the next long radio out. Sorry? He just lifted up and it stayed in the ground. It's just a loop at the bottom of the tine. The question was, how did it get cut at the cat end? And there was no cutting. When he got to the end, he just lifted the tine out of the ground and the copper stayed in it. So now they're going to go out and run the 150 foot. And the trick is, as soon as you get started here. The trick is, as long as that reel is turning, you're getting a good bury. If that reel stops, then your radial is broken. But like I said, I didn't see the entire ground field being put in, but the time that I was there, they never broke a radio, they never hit a rock. It was a very, very clean installation. I think maybe that's why he wanted this machine. He knew what kind of a job it could do. Very particular about that. You'll see when he gets to the end, he'll raise his tine, and then young Clayton here will cut off the radial and bring it to the base of the tower and mend it. This is kind of what it looks like after they're all run. You can see they're all individually bonded to the copper strap on top of that wood framework, and then soldered down. And then we're in the process here of backfilling over the top of it. There's 120 of the long ones and 120 of the short ones. And this is what's he doing here? Oh, this is the transverse strap, the one where I told you where the radials meet in the middle. Rather than carry them out the full 150 feet, they just get cut off. And then you lay a strap here. You can see if you look real close, I can see it on this monitor, I don't know if you can, but you can see the radials kind of sticking out each side of the trench there. So when the strap goes in, it took them a little while to get all those radials soldered to that strap, and then they buried it. There's the lightning arrester, and that's the finished site, finished in construction anyway. So they're all built. The two towers, the building, and we still kept the porta potty because we weren't quite done yet. Because now that this was built, we had to make it run. By the way, my consultant was Ben Evans. I don't know, is Ben in the room today? Ben works out of near Milwaukee, so he did the whole consulting for this entire project. And part of it was the old school to get you started. And then once you get this far, now you switch over to the method of moments process of doing the proofing. There's Ben on the right. Jim Zastro, we contracted to do all of our impedance measurements and all the measurements that are needed for the method of moments computer run. Jim just simply had the right complement of equipment to make this go easy, and he's real well experienced with this. Is Jim here today? No, Jim didn't make it. So the first attempt, and it should have been the only attempt, but it wasn't. Jim used this PowerAIM 120 unit, which is very slick. It attaches to a laptop with a USB port. The RF gets connected here at the end of this cable, and then the computer does a complete frequency sweep and records everything in record time. It goes really, really fast. So we did all the towers, we did all the lines, we did everything we needed to do. This was on a Sunday afternoon. I had to miss a Packer game for it, darn it. And then Jim took the results back to his office, and he was getting them out of the computer and crunching them, and he didn't like something that he saw. And we believe that this is a 1590 kilohertz station. There's a 1600 really close to us in Iowa. And we believe that there was enough of that 1600 getting into the system that it skewed the results of this little guy. So another Sunday, another Miss Packer game. We're down there again, but this time we're using, I'm sorry, one more picture of it. That's inside the ATU. This time, though, we used the good old meter method. We brought in the bridges and the generators and used the field intensity meter to get a deeper null than we could get on the operating impedance bridge. And we took all the readings all over again. And this time Jim was happy with them, so those are the ones that we used to run the method of moments. What we're doing here is we're actually measuring the impedance of the feed line to the tower, which you have to know to input into this method of moments process. I mean, you got to know the impedance of basically everything that you can see to get into this computer run. So that's what we're doing at this point. To be method of moments certified, this is a two-tower. You had to certify that both of your toroidal samples were identical. And so to do that, Rich built this neat little jig, which we mounted inside the phaser. And you can see the transmission line comes off the contactor and goes in through both of them, and then on down to this plug, which goes on to the 50-ohm dummy load. And then we crank the power to it through the transmitter and then read off the phaser. And we're trying to verify that both of these Toyotas, which, by the way, live inside the ATUs, there's no sample loops on these towers. The sample comes from, these are mounted as the last point. I wonder if I had that here. There they are. See it? Right there. That's where your sample is coming back to your phasing, your monitoring equipment. So with this jig, then, this is what you want to see. Between the two, you got a ratio of 1 and no phase difference. And then from tower two, you get the same thing, ratio of one and no phase difference. Ignore the point one, that's within tolerance. And then you do an amplitude measurement, 3.55 amps. And then the tower two is 3.55 amps. And this is well within the tolerable specs to certify that these two samplers were identical. There we are taking the common point impedance measurements. And then after all that's said and done, then by that time it was winter. And we're out there taking the base current readings in the freezing cold and the wind. And well, one of the other things I insisted on with Rich was I wanted a way to mute the station when I'm out at the ATU. Ever since Paul Harvey passed away, there's no longer a long enough pause of any talent to read the null on a base current. I used to love that when Paul Harvey was on. That's when I took my antenna system readings on my first station I worked at. I'd wait till Paul Harvey came on. I'd go camp out at the base of the tower, and he would pause like this long. Good reading, on to the next tower. So I insisted on a button out in the ATU, so when I'm out there with my base current meter, I don't have to wait for somebody to take a long enough breath. I just push the button, mutes the transmitter, and then I take my base current reading. Very slick. Then you run this all through your Method of Moments computer system, and it comes back and it says, okay, based on everything you gave me, here's what your phase and here's what your ratio need to be on your phase monitor. And so we set it, and then we're out in the field taking measurements. We had to do three points on each radial. We did five so that we had a couple to throw away if we didn't like them. So that's what I'm doing out there. And I don't mean to make a commercial, but I don't know of a competing product. I'm using the FIM 4100 from Potomac Instruments there. That is a slick piece of equipment. It's got GPS in it. It's got distance, everything. So you register the center of your array in the device. Then you go out in the field. And while you're driving down the road, you set it on your dashboard and you watch, and it tells you how close you're coming to the radial you want to measure. So you hit, if you're looking for 100.3, you're driving down the road, and by the way, all of our points were on the roads, we made sure of that. Drive down and it comes down to 101, 102, 102.5, 103, stop. Get out of the car, measure the point. It's that easy. Then when you're all done, I think we did the whole array in one day. When you're all done, you take this back to your office, you hook it up to your computer, it spits out this huge spreadsheet with all the data that you did for the whole day. I mean, it's just a slick device, so I apologize if there's a competing piece of equipment. I couldn't find one. Yes?
The other nice thing you have with the FIM 41, though, is you have an excellent record of every meter reading and at what coordinates that reading occurred, so you can go back and replicate 20 years from now.
Yeah, I've saved all the spreadsheets. The only thing you have to do is you have to enter a little bit of metadata, like what are your call letters and what's the date, and you know, you have to make sure you have all that kind of stuff manually entered, what's the number of your point that you're measuring. But the rest of it all does automatically.
Chuck, was it all pretty close, what you measured, to what it was supposed to be theoretically?
I assume it was, because we didn't get any feedback from Ben, so we gave it to Ben, and we did have one little problem. Here's another picture. We took photos of every point we measured. So now in the future, if we ever have to do it again, we just bring out the photo book and we know exactly where we were parked when we took the first one. Well, we had a little issue. When we submitted the Method of Moments proof to the commission, they came back and they said, They said, you've got something wrong. You need, instead of 145.9 as a phase, which was what our run told us we had to be, they said it has to be 144.9, I think. And, of course, Ben didn't like that because he thought he was right for sure. And it turns out after we investigated, there is a constant that had to be injected into the formula for one of the pieces of equipment. It might have been the isocoupler. I don't know. There was something. And we injected it as a negative, and it should have been a positive, or a positive, and it should have been a negative. And that was enough to throw it off, but it was less than 2 degrees. It was like a degree and a half. So the next week, we had to reset it, and I got all my photos out, and I went around, and this time it only took me half a day to take all the readings. Those photos are really valuable. Of course, then you got to finish up with your fencing. Around the guy anchors, we used, they intend to crop this field with low penetration crops yet, and so we wanted to make enough of a barrier so they knew they were getting close to the guy wire in case they weren't paying attention. So we put these huge cattle posts and fences in, buried quite a bit into the ground. So if they hit it, they'll know they hit it. There's Rich taking our ANSI radiation measurements on the inside around the phaser, taking them around each ATU and each tower base. There, you can see the isocoupler there for our STL is mounted there. I think this picture is to show you the signage. You have to go around, you have to make sure there's certain requirements for signage that you have to have on the site. So that was that. There's signage at the front door off the pathway. And then this is the ANSI radiation printout that Rich provided. And you can see that we're well below any hazardous radiation. So that was good to go for there. This is the NRSC sweep measurement. And you can see that we're well below the skirts where we had to be. So the system played really, really well. Now, the method of moments modeling, after the tower and the ground system and the ATU is fully constructed, you have to take your tower base impedance measured at the output of the ATU using a coal bridge with an RF generator, and you have to make sure the other tower is floating. You measure the impedance of the tower feed tubes with the tower grounded, so you can get the impedance of only the tube. So you have to take your sample line measurements. You have to measure the impedance at the antenna monitor with the ATU end open. That will determine the electrical length and characteristics of the impedance, or characteristic impedance, I'm sorry, of the line. You have to verify the sample current transformers. I showed you the little jig that Rich built up to do that. And then after you're done, you have to bring in your surveyor again, so he can recertify that where he told you to put the towers is where you actually put them. So you bring him in, you have him do another site survey, and verify that everything was planted where it's supposed to be planted. And then you set the array parameters that spit out of the method of moments run, and then you go out and you measure the field strength, and we explained that a little earlier. So then to keep it registered, every 2 years you have to do this. You have to verify the ATU current transformer still matched side by side, so I saved Rich's jig so I can do that. You have to verify the sample line's resonant frequency. Basically, go through and verify that everything that you verified in to begin with is still not drifted. And you just put all this documentation of verification into your public file. You don't have to file anything with the commission. You don't have to do anything, you know, unless there's something wrong, then you'll probably want to do an STA and fix it. Now, once the old site is up and running, then we got to take down the, once the new site is up and running, we got to take down the old site. And this was on a very, very, very cold day. I think it was in February of this year. This was a, what do they call this, a wind charger, Rich? A wind charger tower, and it was stubborn. They cut the top guy wires and it would just bend. It wouldn't fall, so they had to go to the next level. And once they cut that, then the tower came down and rested on itself. And so then they had to come in and cut the close guy wires. It was windy that day. And then it came down and fell on the ground. And then essentially we just did the same thing to the north tower. That was a Rhone-type tower, and it fell much easier. All we had to do is cut the top guy wires, and it split in half and fell, and then the second half came down. You could hear a little bit of the wind created by the tower falling. It's pretty awesome, actually. Yes.
Two different towers. Was this originally a non-directional lower power station?
It was originally a non-directional, and then in the 50s they built it, and then in the early 60s they added the second tower and went directional. And I'm not sure, maybe they changed frequencies at that time too. I don't recall that part of it. And then we bring in the dumpsters, and the crew cleans up the mess. Let's see, we get to that. That's what the wind charger looks like. This is the top beacon, didn't survive the fall. And this is the FM antenna, which we had abandoned years ago. The PVL FM used to be, its main transmitter site was here. And we have since built a new site for it out in the country. So this antenna was not being used anymore. And this is the wind chart, Rowan type hotel tower. Then we had when the snow cleared and the frost went away, our last thing we had to do, one of the last things was to clear the concrete for the new owner of the site. I was surprised to see, this is the wind charger tower. That pedestal is only 3 feet long. It was only in the ground 2.5 feet. That really shocked me. You know, the modern day, you're in the ground 7 feet under a tower, at least six. And this is the other tower. This was the one that was added in the late 60s, and even by then they've already realized you needed at least a 6 foot, but it was still only in the ground 2.5 to 3 feet on that tower. And then the very last thing we did, we had a fuel storage tank inside the building, and we had to clear that out, and oh, that was fun. Because the hosing got messed up, and all of a sudden we had a fuel oil shower going on in this room, and I have some clothes, if you like fuel oil smell, that I will sell you really cheap. And that's it. I think we have some time for questions. I did run a little bit long, but thanks to Jeremy for giving me the extra time. I'm sorry.
Copper in the ground at the old site.
Oh, that we were able to leave there. We didn't have to remove the copper groundwood in the old site. I'm not sure how much of it was still there anyway. But it was there, and I drove past the site 2 weeks ago. The house is still there. Everything's still there. So apparently the people who are going to develop the property have run into some kind of delay. So they know that what's underneath the ground, and they're ready for the copper that they're going to encounter. But they insisted that we get all the concrete out. Those two tower pedestals were pretty minor concrete compared to that STL tower you saw next to the old building. That thing had a 12-foot cube of concrete underneath it because it was freestanding. We had to bring in the jackhammers, the huge jackhammers that are on cranes, to bust that apart to get that out of there. That was the worst one. Yes, Chris? Mark? Here, just a minute. Okay, go ahead.
The significant things you heard Chuck talk about was, number one, the feed loop from the ATU to the tower base with, one turn. You have to document that as part of the moment method. The other thing, and it kind of surprised me, is if you have an isocoupler, that thing has ever so slight, like 2 picofarads of capacitance. They want to know that.
They did, and that took a while to find
formula.
Out.
The other thing, you mentioned about the old wind charger tower with the small guy anchors. You realize that's the upgraded version.
Oh, really?
If you go back 5 years previously, they didn't use concrete. 335-foot wind charger tower. There used to be four of them in St. Joseph, Missouri, and one of them came down. We rebuilt the array. But these were built in 1941, December of 41. They got a permit to finish the construction of the station because it was almost done because the war had broken out. This is the 680 kilohertz frequency in St. Joseph, Missouri. Those wind chargers don't have concrete. They have about a 3.5-foot square concave aluminum alloy plate that's probably inch and a half to 2 inches thick. And that's the guy anchor. And that was the point of failure. So you had the rough and tumble wind charger with concrete.
Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, a question on the toroids. You said you had the rig that Rich had built. How much time do you anticipate it will take you to actually do that measurement? And I assume that's downtime then?
Yes, it is. It'll be a full overnighter if the weather's good, because you have to get out to the ATUs. You have to go off the air, go out to the ATUs, pull those out of each ATU, bring them back, mount them in your phaser, take the measurements, and then get them back out to the ATU. So, but we haven't done this yet. Obviously, we haven't been there for 2 years. But if you plan this all, hopefully you can have somebody else there with the meters taking the impedance measurements of the sample lines while you're taking the toroids, and so you can hopefully get this done in one night. It's a little bit of a price to pay to not have to do monitor points, and we don't have to do monitor points once you do it this way. So you save that time. And to answer Jeremy's question earlier, we have been doing our monitor points once a quarter, so we were still doing them. We just weren't doing them every week like you used to have to do in the 70s. So that's what we're hoping. I'm hoping to get a crew together when it comes time to do that. I did notice one thing, though, and I've worked on a lot of AM stations and a lot of AM arrays, and what always bugged me was the swing in the ground conductivity from summer to winter. The ground is much more conductive in winter when it's frozen, and you get a stronger signal. So I was insisting all along, and Rich, you'll recall this, I said, I want this built in the middle of winter. So when we establish our monitor points, they can go nowhere but down when it comes summertime, and then you don't have the headache of trying to stay within your monitor points. Well, then we decided, and Ben came along and suggested method of moments, and it was irrelevant. But I have been monitoring the site. It's solid as a rock, as I told you, and the same ground conductivity issues exist with this array. In the summer, the two points that I've chosen to monitor just for my own satisfaction, one of them went from 27 down to 20 in the summertime. Another one went from 24 down to 19 in the summertime. And I expect they're going to go back up to 27 and 24. We'll see in the middle of winter when I go out and read them then. That's it? Oh, one more.
And would you know?
Say it again.
Have you been hit by lightning yet? And would you know?
To my knowledge, we have not been hit by lightning yet. And the only thing we've been almost hit by, was a tornado. A tornado went through downtown Platteville earlier this year, and we don't have a generator on site, and the entire town and much of the surrounding county around it was out of power for like 2 or 3 days. So it made my argument about getting a generator much more stronger, but unfortunately, once our UPS ran out, we had 5 stations off the air, frankly, at a time when the public needs you the most. Yeah. With the solid state transmitter, yeah, you just need a little generator. So,
okay.
Another one?
Yeah, just one more. In floating the towers, it is merely necessary to pull the J plug at the output of the T network, or do you have to do something else? Because
when you're floating,
the lightning impedance loop is still in the circuit. If it's sitting there in a floating tower, that's just why I asked.
No, when we floated the tower, we simply pulled the J plug right at the end of the ATU and just let her float. When we did the sample line measurement, we had to ground the tower for that one. So we pulled the J plug. Well, we actually disconnected the line to measure it, but we had to ground the tower, and we had some set of cables that were meant to do that. All right. Well, sorry it took so long. We have a break coming up here. The break refreshments are brought to you by Ross Video and. Whoops, try to get back in here. Oh, I got a cow pie here.
Yes. I couldn't find a Belgian pie for him, so I bought him a cow pie. Genuine cow pie from Baraboo, Wisconsin. There you are. Next time it'll be a Belgian pie.
Thank you. All right. Let's meet back here at 3 o'clock for our next session. Thank you very much.